kind of about the present day path that linked back, just out of my own curiosity. And the first is, it's kind of broad, it's about the role of black leadership on the national level. And what this question is driving at is that in reading accounts and interviews of people, that SNCC workers had, there was some amount of jealousy with the King organization back in the 60s. This is implied that it was almost a bitterness when, I guess this would be in places outside of Mississippi, but when King would come to a city and give a speech and mobilize people and leave the dirty work to other people. What I've seen in a couple of television interviews, and one was with the head of the present-day Corps, was the same sort of feeling toward Jesse Jackson, that Jesse Jackson says, I'm registering 1.5 million people, but who's actually doing the work? So my question, and the third part of this, is that a friend of mine was doing an analysis of the Warren County controversy in down North Carolina 2 years ago over the PCBs, where they had, are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
It was in North Carolina, they had a bunch of soil, something like 40 dump trucks full of soil that was contaminated with PCB, which is the chemical that leaks from electric transmitters and light poles, and the state needed to dump it somewhere, and they picked Warren County, which is one of the most poorest and all black counties in the state. And what happened was, there was a local protest movement, and people were actually lying down on the highway blocking dump trucks, and I mean, it got to the point it made national news for a couple of days. But what happened was, in the middle of this local protest, you had a couple, Joseph Lowry came, and a couple other SCLC organizers, and they gave very nice speeches, and they did mobilize energy while they were there, but they left, and when they left, they kind of took some of the leadership potential away from the local people. And so the paradox is, I guess, is that people like King and Jackson release energy, but do they really release it? See what I'm kind of driving at?
Well, it's a question that, you know, we've thought a lot about in the movement, if not necessarily in the form in which you put it. And in fact, I was just discussing it with Sudarshan, who is the fellow I was telling you about, who's working out under Vincent. In discussing the two different forms of nonviolence which got played out within the movement, because there was one initial attempt to build nonviolence as a way of life and the nonviolent community, which people call the beloved community. Mm-hmm. And most notably the Nashville group did that, coming out of the work that Jim Lawson did when he was there. Mm-hmm. And then there was the other idea of nonviolence as a tactic and a strategy to be used in a political situation. Mm-hmm. And that came, I think, into the movement and was pressed most by Byard, and was, I think, certainly within SNCC, there was a wing of SNCC that adopted that. Certainly Carmichael, the people who came down from Washington at Howard, I think were oriented, if at all, when they were oriented toward nonviolence in that way. And I'm not sure about King in terms of his what the official doctrine of SCLC was, or what even his personal, you know, belief was, but in terms of what the practice was, in practice, I think the organization opted for the second, the nonviolence as a tactic, you know, and did not really, I don't think, try to teach or organize people around the notion of a beloved community or nonviolence as a way of life. Now, these two, the methods, it came clearer in my mind that these two methods went with two different approaches within the movement. One, which was mobilizing people, and people who did the direct action demonstrations within SNCC and were geared to a mobilization effort to get people out to demonstrate, or Birmingham, I guess, is one of the prime examples of that, where the students who demonstrated certainly had no belief in nonviolence as a way of life, and if they opted for it at all in that context, it was as a strategy and a tactic in this overall political situation. And that, along with that, goes the notion of the involvement of the media. That is, you have a demonstration and you are also part of the ingredient in the demonstration is the media. Local media, or if you can, the national media, and it's involved in just getting the news and the story out, and it enters into the whole strategy. And so along with that comes this idea of leadership, because with the media you're forced to a spokesman. The media has to, as you know, there's just a few, so much time, you've got to zero in on some image, and so to do that you've got to develop some spokesman. So all of these things, I think, are part of a kind of circle of events which you can trace through the movement. And Jesse's is the latest example of that. Where you have the media and a mobilization effort and leadership, but leadership geared to the media, and so not even necessarily organizational leadership, because for the media you don't need even an organization. All you need is a charismatic personality and some luck, you know. So, and that certainly was what I think King's organization geared to. That is, they geared to establishing King as a national figure, and that meant using the media, and it meant also it shaped the kind of projects that they would be interested in, I think. And it went along with nonviolence as a strategy, as a tactic, and using it in mobilization efforts. Right. Now, the other way, interestingly enough, I think, got played out within the movement in the community organizing that turned out to be an integral part of voter registration in deep South. And to some extent, although it never really had a chance to flower in urban areas in the Deep South, but in those areas, you got involved in organizing as opposed to mobilizing people. And
what's the distinction you're trying there?
Mobilizing and organizing, you mean? Well, I guess the way I think of it, the organizing effort, you're trying to get people to pull themselves together and to provide their own leadership. The mobilizing effort, you pull people together. You don't really care whether they pull themselves together so much or not. You don't care so much how their coming together happens, but you want them to come together. And then you don't really care so much about whether or not leadership develops, and in some cases you might not want it to develop. That is, you might want to leave a vacuum so that when you are ready, you can come back in and mobilize the people again without having to deal with, you know, their own organization or local leaders. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that in this kind of effort turned out to be something that worked very well with the voting in the rural South. And of course, this idea about organizing local leadership was an idea that Ella Baker had talked about for a while, and both when she was with SCLC and when in the founding of SNCC. I mean, it was one of the points around which SNCC differed initially from, I think, from SCLC.
Is that where you got your first taste of that? Or?
You mean from Ella? Yeah, I think so. Well, yes and no. I did have a notion of it before I met Ella, because in the spring of 60, I went down to visit my uncle, who was teaching at Hampton Institute, Bill Moses. And while we were there, I went down to participate in demonstrations if I could, and they did have some, and Wyatt Walker came down to speak. Who's Wyatt Walker became the executive director of SCLC after Ella. He came down, and he was making, at that point, the point about following your leader, that we should have one leader and we should all follow. And I guess it was in preparation for his going into SCLC. I think he had, was already lined up. And I remember talking to him afterwards about this concept. I mean, it just somehow struck me as wrong, you know, and I'm talking to him about the need for a lot of leaders, you know, people all over to taking leadership. And then that was in the spring, and then that summer when I was down in Atlanta and talking to Ella, it was a theme that she, you know, struck. And her thing, one of her things, was that it often turns out that if you line up behind the leader, what she would say was that the leader turns out to have feet of clay, you know, and then you're stuck. Mm-hmm. You know. So she had tried to push SCLC in that direction of grassroots, more grassroots kind of work. And then AMC, of course, was a great local leader, AMC Moore in Cleveland, that when I went to work in Mississippi. And he was himself a great local leader. And
how did you, I mean, what between Atlanta and you going to Mississippi, I mean, just kind of went, or what?
No.
What actually happened?
What actually happened was that Jane Stembridge, who was the executive director of SNCC, asked me to make a trip through Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana to look for students to come to a SNCC conference in the fall, because there hadn't been any direct action, and that they knew of, and they hadn't, therefore, any contacts in those states. So that was, and Ella then drew up a list of people for me to go see, and so, and then I took a tour around, and that's where I met AMC, and agreed to come back and work.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to this concept, so on the one hand, you have this organizing and an effort to build local leadership in order that the organizing can keep going. That is, that the organizer doesn't become the leader in the local situation, but actually tries to build some leadership, or to let the leadership emerge. Which goes along with more with the notion of nonviolence as a way of life, it seems to me. Where in that notion is basically the notion of trying to help people to their own empowerment, self-empowerment, because basically within the notion of nonviolence as a way of life is this notion that each person has something of God in them. I mean, if you're tracing it back now to its religious foundation, and that therefore each person is able to find within him or her the wherewithal to be nonviolent. That is, that you have a resource, an inner resource that you can cultivate and develop, and therefore you have a real practical foundation for, say, personal nonviolence. It's not just something that's some theoretical concept or something. But to do that, you have to develop this notion. And you have to have a practice. And I think what was missing in this country was there wasn't a vehicle, there wasn't a spiritual discipline that people knew about that they could practice.
Mm-hmm.
In India, you had this long tradition of practicing spiritual disciplines,
mm-hmm.
and examples of people. So I think that was something that was there that Gandhi probably, you know, felt used, you know, certainly helped to make that real, you know. So that, it seems to me, in terms of the movement, goes along with the organizing effort, where you're also trying to help people to empower themselves, and goes along with building leadership, right? And so that you got that tension throughout the movement between the two efforts, even though we didn't have a spiritual discipline on which we were building, say, the organizing effort. If we had, we might have survived. We might not have burned out in different ways that we did, you know, and we might have been able to meet the different crises that emerged, you know, in the 60s. But we didn't, and the country didn't. I mean, there was nowhere in the country at that point except, you know, very isolated cases, but it wasn't a part of the culture of the country at all, and it's just now beginning to take a toehold in the country. You know, this interest in meditation and some practicing some kind of spiritual discipline. So it's easy to see why we weren't able to have that, and therefore why this idea of nonviolence as a beloved community and as a way of life, even though it was, the rhetoric was there for it, in certain other snake people, why it couldn't take hold in the organization. So I think that tension has always been there. And we thought a lot about it, although we didn't know about this spiritual discipline part of it then. We knew something was missing. I mean, I always knew that something was missing. And that although myself personally, I could adopt nonviolence, I couldn't propagate it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't talk to local people about it. I mean, it was just something that I felt and something that way that I could hold myself accountable for. Not something that I felt that I had the grounds for really approaching the people we were working with to try to change their attitude about it. And I think the reason was because of this lack of a real spiritual grounding. But even so, we thought about that problem a lot, what was lacking. I don't know if you remember, but the Jackson movement after the Freedom Rides, and the Freedom Rides were really carried into Mississippi by that Nashville group, right? And when they got in there after the Freedom Rides, they wanted to start a nonviolent movement in Jackson, but they weren't able to. And I think just basically what was lacking was just the spiritual discipline to ground their beliefs. I mean, the beliefs were there and in place, but there was nothing grounding them.
Mm-hmm.
So when this thing, you know, about if this question is coming up about Jackson, because Jackson clearly is in the other tradition, that is of mobilizing media leadership. And, I mean, he's doing, he's a genius at exploiting the media.
And to be fair, I mean, the other word that people use is ego. Which is, you know, I mean, that's the criticism that, you know, people use.
Well, that's bound to be tied up with that position.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose you certainly have to have a strong ego to do that.
Right.
I mean, in the first place, I mean, your ego has to be intact.
Okay.
You can't have a weak ego.
Right.
I mean, strong in the sense that, you know, you have to have yourself together in order to do that. But, and then people are bound to take that and make it a question, well, he just wants to project himself. I mean, that's bound to happen in that situation. And other local leaders are bound to feel threatened. You know, I mean, that we saw that time and time again in the movement. On the other hand, you have to be very much intact as a local leader not to be threatened by that. You know, and to understand how you can use that to, you know, to your own advantage, to what it is you want to build in your local community, you know. But that tension, that was there. It's true that was there throughout the movement. It's true about the resentment of King and people feeling threatened by King.
I guess the other part of it, when Jackson first announced, the smallest of his goals, so he said, was that he wanted to get people to register so that black people could start winning local elections.
Right.
And, I mean, the focus right now of his candidacy is not that. I mean,
no, because it's moved beyond. It's,
yeah, and that.
I mean, he's all of a sudden really is a candidate.
Right.
I mean, and which really throws a lot of light about running for president. You know, that it, how much it is a media event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you can somehow capture the media, then you can become a bona fide candidate. And you don't have to have an organization.
Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating that, I mean, the press is, they never knew what to really do with Mondale. I mean, they found him almost boring, but now, They love the union story, the little 52-year-old steel worker who supports Mondo, and that's how they're getting their story now. You know, Mondo wins, they can put all these touching little stories in. Instead of having a dynamic, they don't have Jackson, or they don't have, you know, Gary Hart and his, I mean, it's amazing. Now they like him again because they can run all these stories.
About little people.
About little people, exactly. And
which is good in a way.
Yeah, but it's, yeah. But 30-second spots on at CBS.
And they found a way to project it.
Yeah. Yeah. What about just sheer organizational rivalry? I mean, Mississippi seemed to be one place where that was put aside for a while.
Yeah, well, one thing, what I found when I was there was an overwhelming desire on the part of the people we were working with to have all the organizations work together. And I guess they felt overwhelmed by what they were facing in Mississippi. And they, you know, you kept hearing again and again, we want to see NAACP, SNCC, CORE, we want to see them all working again. And then it just happened to be fortunate that you had people in command posts in the different organizations in Mississippi who were the kind of people who would work together. So you had Meg Evers as the field secretary for NAACP for the state, and then you had Aaron Henry as the chairperson for NAACP, and then you had Dennis as the field secretary for CORE, and then myself. So it was easy for us to put together this concept of, you know, an umbrella organization to cover, do the voting for the state. And that, I mean, that served as a unifying factor, because you could then, you could go anywhere in the state and do voter registration and not have to run into any kind of flak, you know, that you're in somebody's territory, you know, or that you're trying to usurp local leadership or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So that was just part good luck and part good people, you know, in the right position. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, that broke when after MFDP, because then the politics got, people got on different sides of the Democratic Party politics. Mm-hmm. And after that, they were very anxious to make a separation of leadership in the state.
This is after Atlantic City?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just the separation around the reaction.
People who, that they could count on. Then the Democratic Party needed people that they could count on to support them in the state. And so they moved, you know, to support or fund, you know, different people, different projects. Mm-hmm. That, so you got the whole CDGS, the whole poverty program opening up. So then that became a vehicle for funding. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether we answered your first question or whether we got the essence of it or not.
How much did you struggle with the question, personally?
Of
being a leader?
Well, I, you know, the whole, over a period of years, the whole question began to penetrate into my thinking. I mean, it's not something I went down there preconceived, but mm-hmm. over the period of years, I began to work out this distinction in my mind between leaders and organizers, and between organizing people and mobilizing them, right? and what my own role should be, right? And I guess the crux came around the question of whether I should permit myself to become a sort of national symbol within SNCC. Again, for this, the other way this problem comes up is fundraising. And this came up around the question of fundraising, where to, again, because fundraising is based on what people know and image, it's so you rely again on media, and therefore you need a national personality. And so this question came up within SNCC after 64 of trying to develop this within the organization. So it was something that I was against. I didn't want to be such a person. I didn't also want the organization to move in that direction, because then your organizing then begins to get tied into your fundraising. Mm-hmm. And you begin then also to organize around media events, things which will, you know, attract the media.
Right.
Your organization then begins to be pulled and swayed by the whole fundraising mechanism. So that was a big... Well, of course, SNCC got it. I mean, that was Stokely. Stokely became a national media image person. And for a while was able then to help raise money, but then as soon as the media turned against them, then that blew that. It's still a media person, but you have a negative image. Which is really part of the problem. It's a deep problem I have with that whole syndrome of the media leadership, because with Jesse it came up around this quote about the Jewish, you know, characterizing Jewish people. So there you are, the media has made you, and now you can also break it.
Well, Gary Hart almost to the same extent too. And they more or less created him, and he more or less drove him back down.
So it's taken a long while, but even in coming back, this problem presented itself again. Mm-hmm. And it has been clear now to me, very clear, that given my own lifestyle and what it is I want to do, that I should not become a media person. Because the line is a thin line, and once you cross it, it's hard to, you can't turn back. I mean, once you become a media person, it's like media always has access to you.
Coles was telling me a story of the day Eric Erickson made the cover of Time. He said, "This is the beginning of the end. People know about me now."
Right.
There's probably something to that. And he was also telling me, I guess, Alice Walker is being driven crazy. She's suddenly,
media person.
Media. Well, they want her to be. I mean, it's a nice story, right?
Yeah. Well, so I had learned enough, though, in the movement to understand, you know, the little moves not to make to let that happen. Because, I mean, you can say, okay, you do one TV program, you know, and you don't think that of anything about that. You know. So I really have just, you know, systematically not done any media events.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. If you're not a media person, the media can't use you.
Right.
I mean, they just can't throw your name in. Because no one knows it. You know, so your name doesn't, you know, get thrown into the office.
Do you ever have, do you have any sort of frustration about that, though? About isolated is a strong word, but...
Well, let's put it this way. As I grow deeper into myself, into my real self, and a deeper understanding of who I am and, you know, what's important for me, my frustration recedes to zero. I really understand that whatever pull you feel to do that is wrong. You know, and it's coming from a part of you that's not real.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't necessarily saying that doesn't, you know, desire for celebrity or anything, but more, genuine, political feelings. Issues or causes or is that what you're talking
about?
But
you're not prevented from participating, no. That doesn't stop you. You just, you participate. Your participation isn't at a global level, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if you don't have a problem with that, it's a problem, I guess, because if you're used to participating at a global level, you somehow miss it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Trying to think if I can, still thinking about the first question, I guess. It is a...
Lynn Godfrey Phillips.
Come back to it. If could for a minute, can we back up to the early days in Mississippi, and I'd like to kind of get a clear conception of how that grew from Macomb in the first couple of years. You went to Macomb because of
AMSI. Yeah.
And what did
Jet? What happened? Ed King was not the Ed King from Mississippi, the minister, but this was a young black student from Kentucky, I think, who had become the executive secretary of SNCC after Jane stepped down. Jane stepped down in the fall of 60 because of some political problems, disagreement about the conference. And Ed put a blurb in Jet about the voter registration project that AMSI was planning. And then C.C. Bryan in La Palme read it and wrote to AMSI and asked to have some of the people sent down to him. So then AMSI sent me down. And that's how we started in La Palme. And that was in the summer of 61. And then that kind of ended there when we had the demonstrations. And the students walked out of the high school, and a lot of us were jailed.
It's about over Herbert Lee, or
no? The demonstrations were over sit-ins. Marion Barry came down, and he was part of what was called a direct action wing.
Right.
And then he trained some Hollis, Watkins, and Curtis Hayes, who had been working with me on voter registration, and were frustrated, and were local people from the area, young people, to do some direct action. And so they started some sit-ins, and then they involved one other high school student in the sit-ins, and then she was expelled from school, and then the students marched out protesting that, and then a lot of them got arrested, and then we were in jail for about a month. And then afterwards, the students, we got places for them in a Methodist church-related school in Jackson. I'm trying to think of the name of it. I've forgotten the name of it. But anyway, so I kind of followed them, the students, when we got out of jail, on to Jackson to try and keep an eye on, you know, what they were doing, because it wasn't as if it was, you know, a really good school or, you know, anything else. And then, in the meantime, people who had been in the Freedom Rides and been trying to organize in Jackson, some of them were still there, and having failed at the direct action, they were turning to some kind of political action. And then they had gotten the idea of running this candidates for office, Reverend Smith, and I think it was Whitney. I've forgotten the person's name up in the Delta. So then they asked me if I would be the campaign manager for Smith. Mm-hmm. So that got me into that program and traveling in the congressional district of which McComb was a part, doing voter registration at this level of encouraging people to register so they could vote for Smith. And that went on.
You think that made a difference?
It was an important move, I think, in the overall history of what happened in Mississippi, and because it got us into the notion of one, turning people's attention towards the Democratic Party and the actual process of getting people to run for office, and I guess raised in the back of people's minds about what is the Democratic Party, you know, and how is that going to actually look when people do get the vote, will that be in the state? And so it kind of laid the groundwork for the convention challenge in that sense. And it also got people into this kind of parapolitics, the idea of moving as if you were, you know, a bona fide candidate, just move as if there were no barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And this, which into some consciousness, using it as a technique for consciousness raising. And basically then also for organizing, that is, that's where people began to think of what they were doing also as using the political activity and the right to vote campaign as a tool for organizing and setting up people, cadres around the state, contacting people. And that won over a lot of direct action people who had tended to look at the voter registration as a cop-out to the Kennedys or so, something like that, or the federal government. And they began to see it as a way which they could use, a tool they could use to actually get out and organize people without spending half the time in jail. Because the federal government did provide some protection in terms of that organizing, that is, Mississippi couldn't just pick you up and put you in jail if you were organizing around the rest of the world. So after that, then the discussion came about working in the Delta. AMSI felt ready to begin work in the Delta, which he hadn't felt ready to do when I first went down. And so then we recruited about 12 people and spread out in a number of counties.
Where were people recruited from, Jackson?
There was people were around in Jackson, but they weren't, their home wasn't Jackson, but some were at Tougaloo, like MacArthur Cotton, Dory Ladin, some were from Jackson, James Jones, Jesse, Hollis and Watkins were from Macomb area. Emma Bell was from Macomb area. She had been expelled from school, was up in Jackson with the students up there. She went to Greenville. Collier, she was with the NAACP in Jackson. Collier, Liddell. So, and then Frank Smith came over. He was from Georgia, but he came over to work. Sam Block we picked up. He was from the Cleveland area, and after we'd started, he heard about it and came up. Willie Peacock, AMSI, and I went up. AMSI knew his family up in Charleston, Tallahatchie County, so he went up there and talked to them. So it was like one by one, picking up people. And so that took us into the summer of 62. I mean, we spent the spring organizing, getting people spread out and beginning to work. And by that time, we had this, after we had started, I guess after that came the building of this COFO idea. I think we were already in place and working before we had any kind of systematic funding, which lasted a short while.